anywhere. The entertainment industry being in flux because the FCC would like to sell off all that bandwidth from every TV station possible. Make Congress and a whole lot of money. Now we're going to get into political stuff. I'm not really going to do. You know, there's the practical reality that what makes money, what the Chinese and the Japanese do to China is actually now a leading market in terms of entertainment, in terms of what gets developed, where money is put in terms of new development, stuff like that. So sometimes you have to follow the directions of someone else because they're the ones leading the pack. But you know, we have our organization. They're having a hard enough time trying to get their thing together. While the broadcasters are worried about having space to do broadcasting, and you have cable companies now that will give you your phone service and your internet service, and they will provide you with an antenna so you can pick up your local TV station.
In the past year, do you have reason to believe that the number of people watching over-the-air television is increasing, decreasing, or staying the same? What's your guess on that one, Eric?
No guesses required. Nielsen and a few other organizations report on that. They're interested in a lot of what they call cord cutting. And what is happening is more people are going to over the air and OTT, over the top. And over the top means like Netflix, various other through your internet provided service, including your major network.
So if I understand what I've just heard you say, the number of over-the-air television set reception people is on the increase, Eric? Is that sort of what you're saying? Go ahead.
Yes, as you get into urban areas where you'll find that actually companies like Comcast and Time Warner, some desperate themselves, because they're losing customers. Same thing with Cablevision. Look at the ads that are going on between them and buyers. They're hurting.
Okay, Eric, in my standards, that is very encouraging. I mean, if the FCC at one time was talking about thinking of eliminating over-the-air broadcast television, and now the number of customers of over-the-air broadcast television is increasing, then that tells me there is a market for this gold-plated television set with the super equalizer that you and I and Joe are talking about, Eric. I think there's a market for that. The snob appeal or whatever, I would be bragging about the fact that I've got a ninth generation equalizer in my set. I bet you Joe would do that too. W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, go ahead, Joe. Look what you've started.
You know, you even have a channel 3 VHF.
I'm not going to go buy another television. I have enough TVs. But yeah, I want to put my 2 cents in here, just the last closing comment here, Dick. Remember we talked about measurements with some of these signals off the end. Some of them did not look very great. They had like a scallop pattern. Let me give you some information I derived from the measurements I made of those. Let's see. RF-30, and assuming that the pilot carrier is somewhere close to the average level of the digital signal across the rest of the 6 megahertz band, assuming that to be true within a dB or so, assuming that to be correct, RF-30, minus 56 dBm. RF-33, minus 58 dBm. RF-36, minus 56 dBm. So 30-36 is similar, the same carrier level. RF-30-33 is 2 dB less, okay? Now, here's what I derived as far as with putting attenuators in the converter, attuned to those channels, and also making an azimuth change with the antenna. RF-30 took 35 dB of attenuation. RF-36 took 36 dB of attenuation. RF-33 took 24 dB of attenuation to make the picture break up.
And I'll bet you there's a number of different funny things could be going on there. A truly different television digital channel, RF channel, a true different RF channel has different amounts of phase delay going on to the individual antennas at Empire is doing the transmitting. There's less than perfect equalization there. And that particular frequency reflects off the water towers in the southern, on the south shore of Long Island in different ways. So,
water towers, when you say leave that out of the equation, there's nothing within about 5 miles of me.
Even without water towers, there's still a lot of multipath. If I put my eye in the middle of your television aerial and look out there, I'm going to see a hell of a lot of things that are creating multipath. So what you've got to do is move the frequency a little bit from one channel to the next, and the nature of those multipaths are going to add up in very different ways. Anybody have any further questions on over-the-air television, digital broadcast? Give us your call letters right now, K2LIW and the TechNet.
See, that's why I think you see what the patent equalizer is doing.
Beautiful. So that, in other words, where that one channel that only required 24, only allowed 24 dB of attenuation versus 36, with your piece of test equipment, we could find out what's going on there, and that would be a fun experiment. Back to you, Aaron, because you're probably at touchdown. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right. I'm going to the
house. Television broadcast is fun stuff. Let me turn it back to you for a final for tonight, Eric. Joe, to B2LYY, K2LIW.
Okay, here's the final. RF-38 to 20 dB of attenuation. I know these are some of your favorite channels to watch. Here's something else. This is actually a bit of a partial question. Were you watching Channel 2, CBS from New York yesterday at all, any time during the mid-afternoon? Did you happen to have your TV on?
Okay. Essentially, all day yesterday, Channel 2 did not exist at my QTH. Eric, do you know anything about that? K2EJ, K2IW?
Actually, no. I went aware of that, but
Now, let me tell you what I measured when that happened, because it happened to me, and I was very curious, like the scientist, like you are.
Yeah, was that multipath, or was the carrier gone? Over to you, Joe.
The carrier was not gone. I was trying to watch something. I had to go to RF-22 to watch what I wanted to watch from that broadcaster. No, the carry was not gone, but what I did notice was when I looked at the pilot carrier, I actually put the service monitor into SSB mode and went about a KC off frequency to get a beat note. And my service monitor will actually display a listening pattern to tell me precisely where I am as far as I vary the input to audio frequency. In turning the service monitor, I can actually tell carrier-wise what the carrier frequency was. There was something else for a long period of time, about 3 to 4 hertz in difference in frequency, and it was steady in amplitude for a very long period of time. And most of the time, I would not get any picture block up at all. Once in a while, my converter would lock up, I'd get a picture, and then about 10, 15 seconds later, it would disappear again. I don't think it was outside interference because the way my antenna is pointed, there's nothing I know of on RF-33 in that direction that would give me a continuous type of interfering signal that would knock out Channel 2. I tried swinging the antenna towards Hartford, and I get a different carrier frequency slightly, like about 30 or 40 hertz difference, so I know it wasn't them. Whatever this was, what I was going on, was affecting me for a long period of time. The carrier was not off the air, but my decoder just didn't like what it was seeing.
Did it, was the carrier different in frequency, or was it just different in phase?
I can't measure phase. I can only tell you differences in frequency. If one is buried below another one, I can look at one and look at another, and I can measure the difference. I may not be able to measure the carrier frequency exactly and precisely tell you exactly where it was, but with the time base of my service monitor, I can tell, you know, within reason, probably within 10 or 20 hertz accuracy, but I can definitely look at a differential fail. I don't know, but the decoder was very unhappy.
Yeah, well, you know, propagation will be one thing, but I expect it to fluctuate all around. There's another possibility. I mean, I'll have to find out tomorrow what went on. They have something called a backfill antenna. They're ready the heck out of time with the main antenna. If something was going on in combining the mains between the various different filters didn't sit in the right place, there might have been more energy going into the backfill rather than the main antenna. That's why I'm asking if it would stay, because there is a considerable time delay between.
Yeah, almost all day yesterday and last evening, Channel 2 from RF-33 did not exist at my house. The apparent signal strength was zero. I could listen to RF-22 and get reception, but RF-33, CBS, didn't exist all day yesterday. Whatever they did, from my point of view, they did it all day yesterday, Eric. Go ahead. And then I was very happy to see this morning Channel 2 did come back. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Yeah, okay. No, they have a backup set.
The question said someone has a backup transmitter. If someone inadvertently turned on that backup transmitter for a continuous length of time without realizing what they were doing over here 30 or 40 miles away, that would definitely hose it up, wouldn't it?
Now, anything that creates interstitial distortion, meaning even if you were transmitting the exact same thing, you know, 15 or 29 seconds later, will make it impossible to decode.
Now, either my signal strength indicator only works at bit error rate and doesn't have this AGC function for the first third of its bar chart, either that, or something else funny was going on, because I measured zero all day yesterday for apparent signal strength on RF-33. You did see a real pilot tone in there, though, didn't you, Eric? So, Joe. Therefore, it looks like my system doesn't look at AGC voltage. It only looks at bit error rate. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Mine will measure RF signal strength if it can't decode the picture, but that only drive like the first quarter of the scale. Once it locks up on the picture, about 50% to 95% is what you call bit error rate measurement. But I do get picture occasionally.
And I think you're saying you did see real carrier strength. In other words, that first quarter of your signal strength bar was always there. So from your point of view, they were always transmitting. My system was acting as like the carrier was completely gone. Over to you, Joe.
Well, you said that you've lost RF-33 from your location a few times other than this. Is this correct?
I've lost RF-33 on a number of occasions. I've always had some indication of signal strength. All day yesterday, I had zero indication of signal strength, as if the carrier was gone. Over to you, Joe.
Well, maybe you're just at a point where two phases subtract from one another.
But to do that for 12 solid hours during a day, that's a tough one, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I'll make a phone call and see if the bottom of this thing. I mean, could be the backfill. I was putting out more energy than the main energy. But I don't know. It's just a guess.
I'd like to know if other people were experiencing the same grief. So, you did get apparent signal strength. In other words, you never saw a zero signal strength. You saw a carrier all day long, is what I think you're saying, Joe. Go ahead.
Yes, the carrier, the signal strength indicator always indicated that there was something there, just like a weak signal that was out of range. It always was there. I took a look on the spectrum analyzer, hooked to the same point, which is off a coupler on that off of that converter, and I saw the same relative signal strength coming out of New York as I always have done in the past. It really didn't change dramatically. It was maybe 1 or 2 dB weaker in signal strength, but that's nothing compared to what I've got in the past. So that was the answer. It wasn't signal strength. Something else was going on. And as I said, I measured it purposely by interfering with that pilot carrier, and that seemed to be a very sensitive point with these converters. They don't really like that when something interferes on that frequency.
By the way, was NBC and NBC still there?
To me, they were. How about you, Joe?
I checked all the other channels in New York. I didn't lose any other channel, just RF-33. That was the only one that I lost. Nothing else was lost.
Okay, roll out antenna work. Alright, pick it up. Anyway, I'll find out.
We appreciate that, Eric. That was a lot of error, a lot of hours of no signal. And I thought it was something unique about my location, the fact that Joe got it at the same time, and he and I are a good number of miles apart in a different azimuth setting, suggest that something funny was going on at Empire. But only on 2 and not on 4, and I guess you're saying that they share the same antenna. So if it was an antenna fill function, it should have affected both NBC and CBS. And from our point of view, it only affected CBS from Empire. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
Yeah, they're on the same antenna as a couple of other stations. So the other antenna is on the other side, it's Fox. Nine. And, who knows?
One last question, Eric. From what you see right now, is there a very few or a significant number of the Empire stations that are seriously considering going over to the new World Trade Center? Over to you, Eric.
I only get this in little bursts of that. Incentive that the Dirt Organization wanted to protect and everything else. They've made a very incentival type of deal for the broadcast rules there, actually. I think, and don't quote me on this because it could be wrong, that they will actually pay for the move.
That's very nice, because at one time, the New World Trade Center was asking for a certain number of dollars to be held in escrow as a placeholder. And some stations I know of were a little reluctant to give that placeholder money. It was a fair amount of money. So in other words, now, in order to give enticement, I think you're saying New World Trade Center is almost paying for the move for people to go there. And we're not going to quote you on that, but that sounds to me like they feel they've got to do that. Very similar to what happened with the original World Trade Center and the original Empire. The original Empire didn't have enough tenants in the building to make a profit for a whole lot of years. And so the new World Trade is probably running into a similar situation. I think they've got to do some excitement to fill up the building. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
Well, the original World Trade Center, RCA developed the stick industry, all the broadcasts, dying to get onto that thing, because that was higher than anything that, improved the grade B by a major shot. Also, the World Trade Center, this was being built with a major pain because transmitting from Empire, you know how nice and shiny a reflector that place was, and anybody that happened to be living up north, you had to watch 3 and 4 faces of the same face.
Okay, that was a strong incentive to move to the old World Trade. But now, are the people up north getting problems with echoes and shadows and whatever from World Trade, the new World Trade? Are the people up north now listening to Empire, are they in trouble? Or does their digital equalizer take that all out? Okay, where can you already do this?
From what I know, the people that I know that live there, they don't have a problem. I don't think it's like the old days, Well, when they put the ghost cam thing, the GCR in, that came actually at the end before they moved. Yeah, it fixed the problem, but what they did in the interim is they put up UHF north facing only, exactly.
That north facing translator, north only, was that mounted at Empire or at the New World Trade?
No, it was at Empire. As long as there was nothing to shoot downtown, there would be no reflection.
Okay, so I think you're telling me that as long as you transmit signals up north, but don't try to transmit it through. Wait a minute now. Empire, that's right. Empire is considerably north of World Trade. Yes. So if you can create a null in the pattern aimed toward new world, then a lot of the grief disappears. Yeah, but that's a difficult null to create, as I see it, for Empire Broadcast, right?
Yeah, well, they tried. Not that they failed, but you know how effective it is. It's a hard thing to do. That structure was built that was on the Empire. It was Delta was, you know,
back wing.
There ain't too much you can do with them.
At VHF frequencies, I agree with you. But at UHF frequencies, don't you stand a little bit more of a chance?
Yeah, but we're talking about UHF.
To me, RF-33 is UHF, Eric.
Yeah, well, when the World Trade Center was being put up, UHF barely existed, you know. UHF translated plain enough to solve the problem of being able to get a decent analog picture.
Understand. Okay. Looks like you brought up another interesting set of questions here, Joe. I thank you. Let's see if Rich has come back. And if not, we'll pick him up next week as number one on the runway. WB2, Golf X-ray Mike. K2RIW, are you there, Rich?
K2RIW on the net, WB2GXM. Yep, sorry about that. I take care of someone. When they need attention, they need attention. So, regarding the constant current distribution antenna, I am probably going to experiment with building one anyway and see if their claims are correct. And that's basically what it's all about. If you want, we can just progress to the mailbag. WBTGXM.
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of warning though, Rich. Anybody who builds a collinear-like antenna, station master-like antenna, it's very tempting to build the maximum number of elements so you get the maximum amount of performance improvement. It's very tempting to do that. However, I've done some experimenting with homebrew station master-like antennas. I was doing it at 900 megs, so everything is nice and small. I was doing it in a good laboratory with good test equipment. And to simultaneously make all of the phase angles come out right so that the signal really peaks up on the horizon, at the exact same time you get a good standing wave ratio at your favorite frequency or nearby set of frequencies, that combination was extremely difficult. It's a very touchy antenna. As such that if you want to experiment with this, I recommend you crawl up on it slowly. Build a small number of those elements at first, because you're going to discover that the tuning of that thing for both pattern and standing wave ratio, one negates the other, so to speak. You make the standing wave ratio good, and the antenna is aimed up in the air. Make the antenna pattern good, and the standing wave ratio is bad. To make them both come out right is quite a difficult feat. So I recommend you start off with a small number of elements at first. Over to you, Rich. KB2GXM, K2RIW.
I copy that, Dick. I will do. And it's not that much of an expense anyway, so it's all in the spirit of trying things the amateur radio way. All right, thank you, sir, and thanks to the TechNet, or Rich WB2GXM out.
Good luck with that project, Rich. Come back periodically and let us know how it goes, even if it's not going well. Because we like keeping track of people that are doing these home experiments. What kind of mailbags have we had this week, Joe? Here we go. John. And let's see. We're only 2 hours late or something like that. 1 3/4 hours late. Well, we keep a real tight schedule here. KB2. Oh, boy, I'm terrible tonight. KC2, WGV, K2IZM. You know who you are.
I used to know at one time. KC2WGB. Good evening there to everyone on the net. I hope they're doing well. Okay, yeah, I got a good one for you here, Dick. I have a young man who has, he's getting into try moon bounce. He's going to be his first attempt. He has a 400-watt power amplifier. He's got a nice UHF transmitter. He acquired 8 Yagis, diamonds, 15 elements. That alone is about a $1,000 investment if they're new. So now he's wondering about the layout of those Yagis. Should he stack them 2 over 4 or 4 by 2? And how should he go about it? Maybe you can give him some tips. He also has acquired a 8-channel combiner. It's a decent brand. And he's thinking of using that combiner to connect all of the antennas together. So if you could just give him your idea of what his layout should, how it should go, and what the pitfalls and a little more where the mines are located in this field, I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun doing this. KC2WG, back to you, Dick.
That may not be an ideal solution here, but there's multiple ways of finding a solution. The guys who have put up 8 Yagis quite often have done it 4 wide, 2 high. A few of them done it 4 high, 2 wide. And there's probably a couple of other combinations. Quad of, let me think now. Is there a way we can make a diamond arrangement? What I'm getting at is that the maximum dimension determines the maximum beam width in that direction in an inverse manner. You make them 4 wide, 2 high. If you could see that antenna pattern in free space, it would be a vertical beaver tail pattern. Correspondingly, if you make them 4 high, 2 wide, it would be a horizontal beaver tail pattern. That's a fancy way of saying 4 wide, 2 high. It's 4 wide is going to be around 5.5 degrees of horizontal beam width and around 12 degrees of vertical beam width if you make them 4 wide, 2 high. And now, let me drop. You have to also now consider yourself as far as the mechanical problem is concerned. When you make it 4 wide, 2 high, and you become 5.5 degrees wide and 12.5 degrees high in the beam width of this vertical beaver tail, you now need much more accuracy in aiming azimuth than you do elevation. Since most people can set up rotators and indicators and get accuracy in azimuth, and it's a little bit more difficult to get accuracy in elevation, that would suggest that 4 wide, 2 high is easier. Also, for mechanical reasons, when it's 4 wide and 2 high, you're using a smaller amount of mast coming out of the tower, and therefore the antenna tends to be stronger as far as wind loading is concerned. And there's various ways that you could put some kind of a rotary bearing-like mechanism, a sort of a lazy Susan bearing that goes around the tower. In other words, the top of the tower, the top of the antenna is connected to the mast coming out of the top of the tower. Locator is near the top of the tower inside. And then to get greater elevation stability, further down the tower you've got a rotary bearing, a lazy Susan-like bearing that also picks up a portion of the antenna. And now, let me drop the... And now when you're adjusting elevation, you've got some kind of a push rod, so to speak, which is probably going to be a television receive-only actuator. The actuator that tilts a dish on a television receive-only receiving system. Those actuators are very potent, very accurate, real strong, and so to use that as an elevation control is a very handy thing to do. So if I had my choice of 8 antennas, I'd strongly consider 4 wide, 2 high. Because as you start going 4 high, you're using up a whole lot of mast. It's a lot easier to break that mast in the wind, and the amount of push rod required of that actuator is now going to be a hell of a lot longer, and that's more difficult to do. So when it comes to performance of the signal you're transmitting, the real gain, it doesn't matter. The number of Yagis, as long as they've got the proper spacing, as long as they're properly fed in phase, let me drop. That determines the amount of gain you're going to get and how much signal you're putting on the moon. So the spacing of the Yagis and giving them all the right amount of, the equal amount of power. As I was starting to say, equal power and equal phase, you'll get the performance out of the antennas. So your choice is more mechanical than electronic when it comes to which way you're going to go on this one, as I see it, John. And the way guys usually do the division of the transmitter power into eight Yagis, they quite often do it with groups of two-way power dividers. However, there's nothing magic about using a single power divider that's got eight outputs or a pair of power dividers that have four outputs. As long as you carry it out correctly with the right lengths of cables everywhere, all of them work the same. So I think that's the majority of the questions that I've heard on that particular question, John. KC2WGB, don't worry. I know you can go over top of this one. K2RIW in the text.
Okay, Dave, KC2WGB. I hope I'm making it over that. Also, how about a circular pattern of the antennas? If you were to mount them on a halo type of device, it would be a little sturdier, be a little easier for him to adjust his tilt azimuth. You might be able to make a smaller device that way. Would that pattern be acceptable?
You give me a few more words on what you mean by a halo device. In other words, there's a ring-like structure and the antennas around that, mounted on that ring, and are you going to end up with an empty space in between? I mean, each antenna has an effective capture area that's a circle. So when it comes to adding up all of your effective capture areas, it's the equivalent of putting eight quarters on the table, and now you're deciding that all these quarters are going to have edge to edge, they're going to touch each other, so you have no dead space anywhere, and now you're looking for all the possible arrangements. So when you say halo, it sounds like you're making a circle of quarters, okay? You can have six around the perimeter and one in the center. That will be nicely stacked. What do you do with the eighth antenna? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, he could actually divide that halo up into eight areas and bolt it right there. Now, the halo would be standing vertically. It'd probably be maybe an inch and a half square tubing, something like that. And he could mount the antennas directly onto that. And he doesn't even have to put one in the center.
They keep talking about halo and half halo. I hear the word, I'm not getting a picture. Each of these antennas has an effective capture area that's a circle. So now you've got eight quarters on the table. You want the quarters to be stacked as close as possible so they're all touching each other end to end, edge to edge. Tell me how you're going to stack eight quarters into a halo without having any dead spaces anywhere, or without having one sticking out on the side. In a circular pattern, the closest packing you can get is six devices around the perimeter and one in the center. That uses seven antennas. Where do you put the eighth antenna? To make a symmetric pattern. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
If he marked it off in eight divisions, the entire circle, and mount one antenna at each location, that would give him equal displacement around that whole circle. Then he would have a way to mount it. It's one complete circle of, say, inch and a half tubing or inch and a quarter tubing, and the antennas would mount on that, all eight of them on the circle itself. That could be done.
I don't recommend that. I want you to take eight quarters or eight dimes or eight pennies, whatever you got that's all the same. I want you to put those eight devices in a circle where they're all touching each other, edge to edge. Tell me you're not going to have a great big empty hole in the center of wasted space. Over to you, John.
Oh, absolutely there would be a hole in the center. But the antennas should be seeing the same object. I'm just thinking. You might be right, and maybe you shouldn't do it, but I just thought, as a thought, it would make a nice arrangement, and it could be done. Absolutely. And they don't have to be snuggled tight together. They don't have to have their circular pattern overlapping or touching. They could be separate.
And you're using the words of a person who hasn't studied phased array techniques, John. You will adjust them so that they touch each other, so the edge to edge, and you don't want any empty spaces in between. The circular pattern that you just described has a much larger overall area, outer perimeter area, and the disadvantage of that is that as you make the area larger and larger, the main lobe gets sharper and sharper, becomes harder and harder to tune, and as you have empty spaces anywhere, you start developing huge, strong side lobes of the overall antenna pattern. There's only two major disadvantages of this eight circular halo pattern you're describing. Too sharp a pattern, too strong a side lobe. Other than that, it's pretty good. Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Okay, well, I trust your word on it, and that's something you should consider. Also, he'd like to know the cable to use. Airline's a little expensive, but he thinks the cable TV that you always talk about, I think that wire is available to him. He can get like 150 feet of that. So you think that will be all right? Yeah, it's a little mismatch in impedance, but he should be able to work with that. I think that covers most of his questions, yes.
When it comes to low-loss feed line for the diameter, it's very hard to beat 70-ohm cable TV hardline cable. Andrew Heliax makes cable of equal quality, but you're going to pay a lot of bucks for it. The only thing you got to worry about with the cable TV stuff is it's foam-filled, and weatherproofing the ends of it represents a bit of a problem. There's ways you can buy or construct connectors for the end that are weatherproof. There are guys who have used that hardline cable and just literally soldered the center conductor to the antenna at each end and created some kind of a lug for the shield to connect to the antenna. And by the way, to modify each individual antenna to convert it from 50 ohms to 70 ohms is extremely easy to do. I know it'll scare you at first, but that's easy. But when it comes to using 70-ohm cable, there's lots of ways of forcing it to come out right. If the lengths of cable in the phasing harness are multiples of a half wavelength electronically, then the input impedance at one end and the output impedance on the other end are identical, and the impedance of the cable does not matter if it's a even number of half waves. So you can either make the phasing harness pieces of cable that are the exact number of half waves, will equally impedance at both ends, if that's what you want to do, or you can modify the antennas themselves to force them to be 70 ohms instead of 50. That's just lengthening the driven element electronically slightly. It's a lot easier to do, and the article that's in the in both websites, both mic number one and mic number two, will tell you how to do that. Let me drop the article on how to get perfect impedance match of a dipole, which is on Mike number two's website for sure. That's LimeOnTechNet.com. And you, there's an article by K2RIW as to how to get perfect impedance match to a dipole. Well, the driven element of every Yagi is a dipole. And so you can make that impedance anything you want and a perfect impedance match if that's what you want. So that's one way of doing it. But when it comes to a phased array of Yagi antennas, it's really a bunch of quarters on the table. You want to stack them as close as you can get so that the beamer doesn't become too narrow. And by stacking them close as you can get, you make the widest possible beamer, which is easier to steer, and the lowest possible side lobes. Any gaps in that pattern are wasting your ability to make a reasonable beamer of the main lobe and to have reasonable control of those side lobes. So you don't want to use gaps in that pattern, in my opinion. It's not gonna catch on fire because you do that, but you're gonna be living at some mechanical disadvantages and electronic disadvantages if you don't follow those rules, in my opinion. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. I think that's good advice. Sounds good. Now, what do you think his chances are with 500 watts? That's kind of low. I know most of the guys like to run a kilowatt, but do you think he has a chance at 500 watts?
He's got more than a chance. If he's willing to use weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT techniques, guys have done moon bounce on 2 meters with 2 Yagis and 100 watts when using the WSJT techniques, when talking to some of the big guns. You might not hear, well, in the case of WSJT, you don't hear your echo. I was going to say you don't hear your own echo. So among the moon bounce people, there are roughly 2 groups of people. And I'm telling Al, KGUIH, the guy who writes the monthly journal on the EME News, 432 and above EME News, for the last 40 years. I'm suggesting to Al, in order to create a little bit more peace in the house, right now there's a bit of a war going on among the moon bouncers, because there are guys who have done conventional moon bounce with real earphones and real Morse code and real human interpretation, and they've spent 10, 15, 20 years getting their number of states and their number of countries. Let me drop. And along come these guys with digital techniques, and with 2 Yagis and 100 watts on 2 meters, they start making a whole bunch of contacts. And if they're using 4 Yagis and 500 watts, they run up the same number of states and the same number of countries, and they do it in a couple of months, when the previous guys doing it the hard way, it took them 10 or 15 years to do it. And they think this is very unfair. The only way that this can be fair is you have 2 completely separate lists, the so-called totem pole performance lists. You have one list of people who did it the conventional way, and one list group of people who do it with digital techniques. With digital techniques, what you're describing is a high-power station. By analog techniques, the old-fashioned way, what you've got is a definite workable system, but it's a little bit marginal. All the signals you're going to get back from the moon of your own echoes are going to be very weak. I didn't say zero. You're going to copy them once in a while, but they're going to be very weak. A big gun, by conventional techniques, has 1,000 watts or 1,500 watts to the antenna, and sometimes they do it with 8 Yagis on 432. They'd rather do it with 16. And now you've got some extra assurance. And a low noise front end that's under 1 dB of noise figure. Half dB of noise figure if you could get it. So you got a little bit of a conflict of interest on that one. Let me drop. How well you hear the signal from the moon is strongly dependent on whether or not you've got a half dB noise figure at the antenna on the receiver low noise preamp. The preamp's got to be at the antenna, so to speak, to give you best performance. Now you've got to have very good shielding and a very good TR relay, so when you transmit 500 or 1500 watts, the leakage of that relay doesn't wipe out that preamp that's co-located at that antenna. This is the best of all worlds. You'd have 8 Yagis for transmitting and 8 Yagis for receiving, and quite a bit of separation between the two. Well, none of us have got that resources. So to make it work well, damn good low noise preamp. You got to really measure and make sure you've got enough isolation in those relays, and you must use differential keying. When you press down the key on that transmitter comes alive in a few microseconds, but the TR relay takes 10 milliseconds to throw. And so for 9.5 milliseconds, you're transmitting a 500 watts into your low noise preamp. So you've got to have a circuit that does differential keying. You give the command to the relay first, and after the relay has switched and settled down and stopped bouncing, then you enable the transmitter. And when you go back to receive mode, you kill the transmitter first, then you flip the relay. Because when the relay is in its intermediate position between the transmit mode and the receive mode, all 3 connectors are RF-wise connected together. There is no isolation of a relay when it's moving during the time the transmitter is on the air. I wonder if you see the concept on that one, John. That's very important. Otherwise, you're going to be wiping out preamps every single day. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Very good information, Dick. You never mentioned a preamp in this structure. You may not have it yet, or maybe you didn't even consider it yet. And the Joe Taylor technique he will be using, this is all new to him. He may get into it eventually down the line. But I think he has to do a little more reading and go to that PME site that you said, maybe he can glean some knowledge from them that might help him in his project. Because I know that's what he wants to do. He wants to be able to say hello and listen to his voice come back. Because that's the whole idea here, from what I understand. Not so much to talk to people yet. But, okay, good enough. And I hope he makes out well with this. He's getting a lot of money involved here. I hope it does work. Okay, that's it from the mailbag, Dick. Back to you, and we'll go on to Paul.
There is a tremendous amount of data available to you. The monthly, lunar monthly published journal for 40 solid years by K2UIH, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel, which is, I've forgotten his name. my goodness. Anyhow, Alan Sack, Alan Katz. Alan Katz, K-A-T-Z. Alan Katz, K2UIH. If you Google the word 432 and above EME News, K2UIH, Alan Katz, any of those combinations, you'll eventually find the archive where you can download them in PDF or any other mode format you want. Essentially all of those journals for the last 40 years, and each one of those journals is about 8 pages long, each side 8 pages, 4 pieces of paper on both sides. And they've got beautiful articles as to what people did that was and wasn't successful, beautiful pictures of what all these antennas look like, what guys have done, what they've done to get azimuth indication, elevation indication, computer calculating as to where the moon is going to be, what day of the month is the right day to do moon bounce, where the moon is at perigee instead of apogee, and when the moon is not in front of the center of the universe, where the universe is making a whole lot of noise, and when it falls into a convenient hour for people to be awake as opposed to sleeping. There's all kinds of information there. And if you start reading those articles, guarantee you'll learn an awful lot. And so you got to go there, if you know what I mean. These guys have been doing serious moon bounce now since roughly 1970. So there's 40 some odd years of research there by guys in, there's at least 1,000 or 1,500 people who have done successful moon bounce in probably 30 different countries. And each one of those guys has got a different solution as to if he used a dish, what did he use for a feed on? If he used a Yagi, which Yagi did he use? How many of them? How did he stack them? How did he mechanically connect them to each other? What kind of a preamp? How did he establish the transmit-receive relay around that preamp to protect it? How did he do the differential keying circuit? What kind of a transmitter? What kind of a receiver? How much stability? How much Doppler shift? There's a lot to it. It does separate the men from the boys to do it in the conventional way without the digital techniques. And is it more desirable to use the digital techniques or not to use the digital techniques? That's an individual decision. And that's not an easy one. But you're going to be joining one group of guys or the other. And each group of guys is a little bit unhappy about the existence of the other group, if you know what I mean. Okay, good luck with that project. And I think he's going to eventually come back with a lot more questions, John. KC2WG.
Repeater, timeout.
Any final comments on this, John, before I go over to the space report? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yeah, his name is Paul. I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun with this, but he's got to be careful. He's spending a lot of money here. I believe those antennas are brand new, so I wish him a lot of luck with it, and I'm sure he'll be back with more questions. So, all right. Go to Paul and see what's happening in space. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
I do see two good things that have happened this week, Paul. Three space station astronauts came back home safely. And also the Philly, I think it's called, that little bitty spacecraft that got landed a year or so ago on that asteroid. It suddenly came back to life this week. In other words, the sun in that hole where it's located, in that valley where it's located, the sun started shining onto its solar cells, charged its batteries, it came back, and it reported back home, hey, I'm here, I'm alive. WS2N, K2LAW, Vanpool.
Okay, it was good to see that thing come back. That was back in November, so that's been out of commission for a long time. It landed in that shady area, they believe. They know where it is, pretty close to where it is, exactly on the comet, but given that they have a signal, it's given reports of how the spacecraft is doing, you know, power output, 24 watts, you know, but it's not being commanded yet to start sending more science. They plan on doing that as soon as possible, because they think it might be operational until October. So, one thing they'd like to do is exactly pinpoint where it is. They'll be able to do that now, as long as it keeps operating. It came back to life about 3 days before it actually transmitted. It had to build up power in the batteries, and off it went. So, very good for the European Space Agency and for NASA. NASA has test equipment on board that spacecraft, as well as the Rosetta spacecraft, the mother spacecraft that's flying around the comet. I did want to mention the test of the low-density supersonic decelerator, the GLDSD. And I've talked about it before, last week included. It was supposed to come, you know, be tested on the 2nd, and then every day after that, delay, due to the winds. They didn't want this balloon that carries it, balloon as big as Shea Stadium, you know, carrying this thing up and floating in the wrong direction over populated areas in Hawaii. So they waited, and sure enough, it was the day after last week's net, on Monday, late afternoon, Eastern Standard Time, they were able to finally drop this thing from the balloon. And, test to see if this thing would work. The reason it's up so high is they're trying to duplicate the rarefied air that you have on Mars. The goal is to eventually land a heavier machinery and rockets and equipment on Mars. Right now, they've reached their limit, a little over 1 ton. For instance, the Curiosity weighed a little over 1 ton. Not when it got to Mars. You know, Mars is 1/3 the weight, but that's their maximum weight. And they need to have a bigger landing vehicle to do, you know, future Mars missions, including eventually manned missions. So this thing went off without a hitch in the beginning. Similar to last year, they ran the same type of test last year. This diameter is about 20 feet in diameter. Really, they call it 6 meter. But roughly about 20 meters in diameter. And it goes up to 120,000 feet. Then it gets released by this balloon. And it's a big flying saucer looking thing with it. On the back of it is a solid rocket engine. So this thing gets dropped, solid rocket engine accelerates the speed and height. Also, it goes up another 60,000 feet, so it gets up to around 180,000 feet. That's where the equivalent of the air on in Mars atmosphere is. And the thing ignited properly, got up to 4,000 miles per hour. And then it goes through a coast phase, and then this thing inflates. This low-density supersonic decelerator inflates, and that slows it down very quickly to a little over 2 pulls the big parachute out. They tried it last year, and the parachute didn't work last year. It tore So this year, everything, you know, went fine with the test, except for this parachute again. And they tried a different type of parachute. I've seen there what they had on the internet. Basically a stronger parachute. Well, it looked like it was worse than last year. So I'm going to have to go back to the drawing boards on this 100-foot diameter parachute, twice as big as what they used for Curiosity. It's roughly about 50 feet in diameter. They have to try to get this thing to work and slow it down properly. And we'll see what happens, though. They had enough money for 3 tests last year, this year, and next year. So it looks like next year they had planned on a larger version next year. This is 6 meter. Next year they want to do an 8 meter one. It's a little different than this one. They actually have, you know, nitrogen or whatever it is, the to pressurize the diameter of this thing, to increase the diameter to, you know, anything fall through an atmosphere. The diameter is increased, it will slow down, that's the idea of it. And this other one, instead of having charges inflating it, it's going to have, you know, when it opens up, it's got these air intakes, and it's going to take the supersonic air at 4,000 miles per hour, and the air is going to inflate the SIAD. They call these SIADs. And then stands for supersonic inflatable aerodynamic decelerator. And it's called the E model. This one is the SIAD R. They've tested last year and this year. And now they're going to go to a bigger one next year. Of course, the parachute failure, I guess they're going to have to try to shake more money out of NASA, really Jet Propulsion Laboratory, that's really involved with this. And, maybe have another test or two next year. So, I mean, they have plenty of time. I can imagine, you know, decades now before they really put this thing into use, send the spacecraft of some sizable size and weight to Mars. So I guess they have time to raise the money, drop it. What you mentioned before, that 3 astronauts did come back successfully after 200 days in space. They stayed an extra month. There's 6 people on the space station, and these 3 came back. Now there's 3 left on the space station. And they were supposed to come back a month ago, but due to the Progress failure, you know, they had a cargo launch back in late April, and that failed. They decided to leave the crew up there a little longer, not only to check out the Progress problem of what went wrong before they bring them back, but also to, you know, leave 6 people on board to get some kind of science done. There's a lot of maintenance that goes on the space station, and with 6 people and eventually 7 people in a couple of years, those extra people on board, they're able to get a lot more science done. This is WS-2. So, they brought back Terry Burtz. He was instrumental in a couple of spacewalks, getting ready for the new NASA docking adapter that's going to be coming up, actually, at the end of this month, right before field day on a Friday. They'll be launching another Falcon 9 by SpaceX Dragon spacecraft up to the International Space Station with cargo on board, but also in the trunk, the back of the Dragon spacecraft, they're going to be carrying up a NASA docking adapter, newer docking adapters. They plan on sending 2 up, and what these things are going to do are they're going to attach to the existing PMAs, pressure mating adapters, on the International Space Station, and allow any manned space program. Recently, it will be the new Dragon spacecraft with crew
on board, and eventually the Boeing CST-100 also will have a crew on board. They'll be able to dock to these